Chapter 22. Jonathan Harker's Journal. 3rd of October. As I must do something or go mad, I write this diary. It is now 6 o'clock, and we are to meet in the study in half an hour and take something to eat. For Dr. Van Helsing and Dr. Seward are agreed that if we do not eat, we cannot work our best. Our best will be, God knows, required today. I must keep writing at every chance, for I dare not stop to think. All, big and little, must go down. Perhaps at the end the little things may teach us most. The teaching, big or little, could not have landed Mina or me anywhere worse than we are today. However, we must trust and hope. Poor Mina told me just now, with the tears running down her dear cheeks, that it is in trouble and trial that our faith is tested, that we must keep on trusting, and that God will aid us up to the end. The end. Oh, my God. What end? To work. To work. When Dr. Van Helsing and Dr. Seward had come back from seeing poor Renfield, we went gravely into what was to be done. First, Dr. Seward told us that when he and Dr. Van Helsing had gone down to the room below, they had found Renfield lying on the floor all in a heap. His face was all bruised and crushed in, and the bones of the neck were broken. Dr. Seward asked the attendant who was on duty in the passage if he had heard anything. He said that he had been sitting down, he confessed to half-dozing, when he heard loud voices in the room, and then Renfield had called out loudly several times, "God! God! God!" After that, there was a sound of falling, and when he entered the room he found him lying on the floor, face down. Van Helsing asked if he had heard voices or a voice, and he said he could not say, that at first it had seemed to him as if there were two, but as there was no one in the room it could have been only one. He could swear to it, if required, that the word God was spoken by the patient. Dr. Seward said to us when we were alone that he did not wish to go into the matter. The question of an inquest had to be considered, and it would never do to put forward the truth, as no one would believe it. As it was, he thought that on the attendant's evidence he could give a certificate of death by misadventure in falling from bed. In case the coroner should demand it, there would be a formal inquest, necessarily to the same result. When the question began to be discussed as to what should be our next step, the very first thing we decided was that Mina should be in full confidence, that nothing of any sort, no matter how painful, should be kept from her. She herself agreed as to its wisdom, and it was pitiful to see her so brave and yet so sorrowful, and in such a depth of despair. "There must be no more concealment," she said. "Alas, we have had too much already. And besides, there is nothing in all the world that can give me more pain than I have already endured, than I suffer now. Whatever may happen, it must be of new hope or of new courage to me." Van Helsing was looking at her fixedly as she spoke, and said suddenly but quietly, "But, dear Madam Mina, are you not afraid, not for yourself, but for others from yourself, after what has happened?" Her face grew set in its lines, but her eyes shone with the devotion of a martyr, as she answered, "Ah, no, for my mind is made up." "To what?" he asked gently, whilst we were all very still, for each in our own way we had a sort of vague idea of what she meant. Her answer came with direct simplicity, as though she were simply stating a fact. "Because if I find in myself, and I shall watch keenly for it, a sign of harm to any that I love, I shall die."
"You would not kill yourself?"
he asked hoarsely. "I would, if there were no friend who loved me, who would save me such a pain and so desperate an effort." She looked at him meaningly as she spoke. He was sitting down, but now he rose and came close to her and put his hand on her head as he said solemnly, "My child, there is such an one if it were for your good. For myself, I could hold it in my account with God to find such an euthanasia for you, even at this moment, if it were best. Nay, were it safe. But my child!" For a moment he seemed choked, and a great sob rose in his throat. He gulped it down and went on, "There are here some who would stand between you and death. You must not die. You must not die by any hand, but least of all by your own. Until the other, who has fouled your sweet life, is true dead, you must not die, for if he is still with the quick undead, your death would make you even as he is. No, you must live. You must struggle and strive to live, though death would seem a boon unspeakable. You must fight death himself, though he come to you in pain or in joy, by the day or the night, in safety or in peril. On your living soul I charge you that you do not die, nay, nor think of death, till this great evil be past. The poor deer grew white as death, and shook and shivered, as I have seen a quicksand shake and shiver at the incoming of the tide. We were all silent. We could do nothing. At length she grew more calm, and turning to him, said sweetly, but oh so sorrowfully, as she held out her hand, I promise you, my dear friend, that if God will let me live, I shall strive to do so, till, if it may be in his own good time, this horror may have passed away from me. She was so good and brave that we all felt that our hearts were strengthened to work and endure for her, and we began to discuss what we were to do. I told her that she was to have all the papers in the safe, and all the papers or diaries and phonographs we might hereafter use, and was to keep the record as she had done before. She was pleased with the prospect of anything to do, if pleased could be used in connection with so grim an interest. As usual, Van Helsing had thought ahead of everyone else, and was prepared with an exact ordering of our work. "It is perhaps well," he said, "that at our meeting after our visit to Carfax we decided not to do anything with the earth-boxes that lay there. Had we done so, the Count must have guessed our purpose, and would doubtless have taken measures in advance to frustrate such an effort with regard to the others. But now he does not know our intentions. Nay, more, in all probability he does not know that such a power exists to us as can sterilize his lairs, so that he cannot use them as of old. We are now so much further advanced in our knowledge as to their disposition, that when we have examined the house in Piccadilly, we may track the very last of them. Today, then, is ours, and in it rests our hope. The sun that rose on our sorrow this morning guards us in its course. Until it sets to-night, that monster must retain whatever form he now has. He is confined within the limitations of his earthly envelope. He cannot melt into thin air, nor disappear through cracks or chinks or crannies. If he go through a doorway, he must open the door like a mortal. And so we have this day to hunt out all his lairs and sterilize them. So we shall, if we have not yet catch him and destroy him, drive him to bay in some place where the catching and the destroying shall be in time sure." Here I started up, for I could not contain myself at the thought that the minutes and seconds so previously laden with Mina's life and happiness were flying from us, since whilst we talked action was possible. But Van Helsing held up his hand warningly. "Nay, friend Jonathan," he said, "in this the quickest way home is the longest way, so your proverb says. We shall all act, and act with desperate quick when the time has come. But think, in all probable the key of the situation is in that house in Piccadilly. The Count may have many houses which he has bought. Of them he will have deeds of purchase, keys and other things. He will have papers that he write on. He will have his book of checks. There are many belongings that he must have somewhere. Why not in this place so central, so quiet, where he come and go by the front or the back at all hour, when in the very vast of the traffic there is none to notice? We shall go there and search that house, and when we learn what it holds, then we do what our friend Arthur call, in his phrases of hunt, stop the earth, and so we run down our old fox. So, is it not?" "Then let us come at once," I cried. "We are wasting the precious, precious time." The professor did not move, but simply said, "And how are we to get into that house in Piccadilly?" "Anyway," I cried, "we shall break in if need be."
"And your police?
Where will they be, and what will they say?" I was staggered, but I knew that if he wished to delay, he had a good reason for it. So I said, as quietly as I could, "Don't wait more than need be. You know, I am sure, what torture I am in."
"Ah, my child, that I do.
And indeed there is no wish of me to add to your anguish. But just think, what can we do, until all the world be at movement? Then will come our time. I have thought and thought, and it seems to me that the simplest way is the best of all. Now we wish to get into the house, but we have no key. Is it not so?" I nodded. "Now suppose that you were in truth the owner of that house, and could not still get in, and think there was to you no conscience of the housebreaker, what would you do?"
"I should get a respectable locksmith, and set him to work to pick the lock for me."
"And your police, they would interfere, would they not?"
"Oh, no, not if they knew the man was properly employed."
"Then," he looked at me keenly as he spoke, "all that is in doubt is the conscience of the employer, and the belief of your policeman as to whether or no that employer has a good conscience or a bad one.
Your police must indeed be zealous men and clever, oh, so clever in reading the heart that they trouble themselves in such matter. No, no, my friend Jonathan. You go take the lock off 100 empty houses in this your London, or of any city in the world, and if you do it as such things are rightly done, and at the time such things are rightly done, no one will interfere. I have read of a gentleman who owned a so fine house in your London, and when he went for months of summer to Switzerland and lock up his house, some burglar came and broke window at back and got in. Then he went and made open the shutters in front and walk out and in through the door before the very eyes of the police. Then he have an auction in that house, and advertise it, and put up big notice. And when the day come, he sell off by a great auctioneer all the goods of that other man who owned them. Then he go to a builder, and he sell him that house, making an agreement that he pull it down and take all away within a certain time. And your police and other authority help him all they can. And when that owner come back from his holiday in Switzerland, he find only an empty hole where his house had been. This was all done en règle, and in our work we shall be en règle too. We shall not go so early that the policeman who have then little to think of shall deem it strange, but we shall go after 10 o'clock, when there are many about, and when such things would be done were we indeed owners of the house. I could not but see how right he was, and the terrible despair of Mina's face became relaxed, a thought. There was hope in such good counsel. Van Helsing went on. When once within that house we may find more clues. At any rate, some of us can remain there, whilst the rest finds the other places where there be more earth-boxes, at Bermondsey and Mile End. Lord Godalming stood up. I can be of some use here, he said. I shall wire to my people to have horses and carriages where they will be most convenient. Look here, old fellow, said Morris. It is a capital idea to have all ready in case we want to go horsebacking, but don't you think that one of your snappy carriages with its heraldic adornments in a byway at Walworth or Mile End would attract too much attention for our purposes? It seems to me that we ought to take cabs when we go south or east, and even leave them somewhere near the neighbourhood we are going to. Friend Quincy is right, said the professor. His head is what you call in plane with the horizon. It is a difficult thing that we go to do, and we do not want no peoples to watch us, if so it may. Mina took a growing interest in everything, and I was rejoiced to see that the exigency of affairs was helping her to forget, for a time, the terrible experience of the night. She was very, very pale, almost ghastly, and so thin that her lips were drawn away, showing her teeth somewhat prominently. I did not mention this last, lest it should give her needless pain, but it made my blood run cold in my veins to think of what had occurred with poor Lucy when the Count had sucked her blood. And yet there was no sign of the teeth growing sharper. But the time as yet was short, and there was time for fear. When we came to the discussion of the sequence of our efforts and of the disposition of our forces, there were new sources of doubt. It was finally agreed that before starting for Piccadilly we should destroy the Count's lair close at hand. In case he should find it out too soon, we should thus be still ahead of him in our work of destruction, and his presence in his purely material shape, and at his weakest, might give us some new clue. As to the disposal of forces, it was suggested by the professor that, after our visit to Carfax, we should all enter the house in Piccadilly, that the two doctors and I should remain there, whilst Lord Godalming and Quincy found the lairs at Walworth and Mile End and destroyed them. It was possible, if not likely, the professor urged, that the Count might appear in Piccadilly during the day, and that if so we might be able to cope with him then and there. At any rate we might be able to follow him in force. To this plan I strenuously objected, in so far as my going was concerned, for I said that I intended to stay and protect Mina. I thought that my mind was made up on the subject, but Mina would not listen to my objection. She said that there might be some law matter in which I could be useful, that amongst the Count's papers might be some clue which I could understand out of my experience in Transylvania, and that, as it was, all the strength we could muster was required to cope with the Count's extraordinary power. I had to give in, for Mina's resolution was fixed. She said that it was the last hope for her that we should all work together. As for me, she said, I have no fear. Things have been as bad as they can be, and whatever may happen must have in it some element of hope or comfort. Go, my husband. God can, if he wishes, guard me as well alone as with anyone present. So I started up, crying out, Then in God's name let us come at once, for we are losing time.
"'The Count may come to Piccadilly earlier than we think.'
"'Not so,' said Van Helsing, holding up his hand.
"'But why?' I asked.
"'Do you forget?' he said, with actually a smile, "'that last night he banqueted heavily and will sleep late.'
"'Did I forget? Shall I ever? Can I ever?
"'Can any of us ever forget that terrible scene?' Mina struggled hard to keep her brave countenance, but the pain overmastered her, and she put her hands before her face and shuddered whilst she moaned. Van Helsing had not intended to recall her frightful experience. He had simply lost sight of her and her part in the affair in his intellectual effort. When it struck him what he had said, he was horrified at his thoughtlessness and tried to comfort her.
"'Oh, Madame Mina,' he said, "'Dear, dear Madame Mina, alas, that I, of all who so reverence you, should have said anything so forgetful. These stupid old lips of mine and this stupid old head do not deserve so, but you will forget it, will you not?'
He bent low beside her as he spoke. She took his hands and, looking at him through her tears, said hoarsely,
"'No, I shall not forget, for it is well that I remember, and with it I have so much in memory of you that is sweet that I take it all together.' "'Now you must all be going soon. Breakfast is ready, and we must all eat that we may be strong.'
Breakfast was a strange meal to us all. We tried to be cheerful and encourage each other, and Mina was the brightest and most cheerful of us. When it was over, Van Helsing stood up and said, "'Now, my dear friends, we go forth to our terrible enterprise. Are we all armed, as we were on that night when first we visited our enemy's lair, armed against ghostly as well as carnal attack?'
We all assured him.
"'Then it is well. Now, Madame Mina, you are in any case quite safe here until the sunset, and before then we shall return. We shall return, but before we go let me see you armed against personal attack. I have myself, since you came down, prepared your chamber by the placing of the things of which we know, so that he may not enter. Now let me guard yourself. On your forehead I touch this piece of sacred wafer, in the name of the Father, the Son, and—'
There was a fearful scream which almost froze our hearts to hear. As he placed the wafer on Mina's forehead, it had seared it, had burned into the flesh as though it had been a piece of white-hot metal. My poor darling's brain told her the significance of the fact as quickly as her nerves received the pain of it, and the two so overwhelmed her that her overwrought nature had its voice in that dreadful scream. But the words to her thought came quickly. The echo of the scream had not ceased to ring on the air when there came the reaction, and she sank on her knees on the floor in an agony of abasement. Pulling her beautiful hair over her face, as the leper of old his mantle, she wailed out,
"'Unclean! Unclean! Even the Almighty shuns my polluted flesh! I must bear this mark of shame upon my forehead until the judgment day!'
They all paused. I had thrown myself beside her in an agony of helpless grief, and putting my arms around held her tight. For a few minutes our sorrowful hearts beat together, whilst the friends around us turned away their eyes that ran tears silently. Then Van Helsing turned and said gravely, so gravely that I could not help feeling that he was in some way inspired and was stating things outside himself,
"'It may be that you may have to bear that mark till God himself see fit, as he most surely shall on the judgment day to redress all wrongs of the earth and of his children that he has placed thereon. And, oh, Madame Mina, my dear, may we who love you be there to see when that red scar, the sign of God's knowledge of what has been, shall pass away and leave your forehead as pure as the heart we know. For so surely as we live that scar shall pass away, when God see right to lift the burden that is hard upon us. Till then we bear our cross, as his Son did in obedience to his will. It may be that we are chosen instruments of his good pleasure, and that we ascend to his bidding, as that other through stripes and shame, through tears and blood, through doubts and fears, and all that makes the difference between God and man."
There was hope in his words, and comfort, and they made for resignation. Mina and I both felt so, and simultaneously we each took one of the old man's hands, and bent over and kissed it. Then without a word we all knelt down together, and, all holding hands, swore to be true to each other. We men pledged ourselves to raise the veil of sorrow from the head of her whom, each in his own way, we loved, and we prayed for help and guidance in the terrible task which lay before us. It was then time to start. So I said farewell to Mina, a parting which neither of us shall forget to our dying day, and we set out. To one thing I have made up my mind. If we find out that Mina must be a vampire in the end, then she shall not go into that unknown and terrible land alone. I suppose it is thus that in old times one vampire meant many. Just as their hideous bodies could only rest in sacred earth, so the holiest love was the recruiting sergeant for their ghastly ranks. We entered Carfax without trouble and found all things the same as on the first occasion. It was hard to believe that amongst so prosaic surroundings of neglect and dust and decay there was any ground for such fear as we already knew. Had not our minds been made up, and had there not been terrible memories to spur us on, we could hardly have proceeded with our task. We found no papers, nor any sign of use in the house, and in the old chapel the great boxes looked just as we had seen them last. Dr. Van Helsing said to us solemnly as we stood before them, "And now, my friends, we have a duty here to do. We must sterilize this earth so sacred of holy memories that he has brought from a far distant land for such fell use. He has chosen this earth because it has been holy. Thus we defeat him with his own weapon, for we make it more holy still. It was sanctified to such use of man. Now we sanctify it to God." As he spoke, he took from his bag a screwdriver and a wrench, and very soon the top of one of the cases was thrown open. The earth smelled musty and close, but we did not somehow seem to mind, for our attention was concentrated on the professor. Taking from his box a piece of the sacred wafer, he laid it reverently on the earth, and then, shutting down the lid, began to screw it home, we aiding him as he worked. One by one we treated in the same way each of the great boxes, and left them as we had found them to all appearance, but in each was a portion of the host. When we closed the door behind us, the professor said solemnly, "So much is already done. If it may be that with all the others we can be so successful, that the sunset of this evening may shine on Madame Mina's forehead all white as ivory, and with no stain." As we passed across the lawn on our way to the station to catch our train, we could see the front of the asylum. I looked eagerly, and in the window of my room saw Mina. I waved my hand to her, and nodded to tell that our work there was successfully accomplished. She nodded in reply to show that she understood. The last I saw she was waving her hand in farewell. It was with a heavy heart that we sought the station and just caught the train, which was steaming in as we reached the platform. I have written this in the train. Piccadilly, 12:30 o'clock. Just before we reached Fenchurch Street, Lord Godalming said to me, "Quince and I will find a locksmith. You had better not come with us in case there should be any difficulty, for under the circumstances it wouldn't seem so bad for us to break into an empty house, but you are a solicitor, and the Incorporated Law Society might tell you that you should have known better." I demurred as to my not sharing any danger even of odium, but he went on, "Besides, it will attract less attention if there are not too many of us. My title will make it all right with the locksmith and with any policeman that may come along. You had better go with Jack and the professor, and stay in the Green Park, somewhere in sight of the house. And when you see the door open and the smith has gone away, do you all come across. We shall be on the lookout for you, and will let you in." "The advice is good," said Van Helsing, so we said no more. Godalming and Morris hurried off in a cab, we following in another. At the corner of Arlington Street our contingent got out and strolled into the Green Park. My heart beat as I saw the house on which so much of our hope was centred, looming up grim and silent in its deserted condition amongst its more lively and spruce-looking neighbours. We sat down on a bench within good view, and began to smoke cigars so as to attract as little attention as possible. The minutes seemed to pass with leaden feet as we waited for the coming of the others. At length we saw a four-wheeler drive up. Out of it, in leisurely fashion, got Lord Godalming and Morris, and down from the box descended a thick-set working man with his rush-woven basket of tools. Morris paid the cabman, who touched his hat and drove away. Together the two ascended the steps, and Lord Godalming pointed out what he wanted done. The workman took off his coat leisurely and hung it on one of the spikes of the railing, saying something to a policeman who just then sauntered along. The policeman nodded acquiescence, and the man, kneeling down, placed his bag beside him. After searching through it, he took out a selection of tools which he proceeded to lay beside him in orderly fashion. Then he stood up, looked into the keyhole, blew into it, and turning to his employers made some remark. Lord Godalming smiled,
and the man lifted a good-sized bunch of keys. Selecting one of them, he began to probe the lock, as if feeling his way with it. After fumbling about for a bit, he tried a second, and then a third. All at once the door opened under a slight push from him, and he and the two others entered the hall. We sat still. My own cigar burnt furiously, but Van Helsing's went cold altogether. We waited patiently as we saw the workman come out and take in his bag. Then he held the door partly open, steadying it with his knees, whilst he fitted a key to the lock. This he finally handed to Lord Godalming, who took out his purse and gave him something. The man touched his hat, took his bag, put on his coat, and departed. Not a soul took the slightest notice of the whole transaction. When the man had fairly gone, we three crossed the street and knocked at the door. It was immediately opened by Quincey Morris, beside whom stood Lord Godalming, lighting a cigar. "The place smells so vilely," said the latter as we came in. It did indeed smell vilely, like the old chapel at Carfax, and with our previous experience it was plain to us that the Count had been using the place pretty freely. We moved to explore the house, all keeping together in case of attack, for we knew we had a strong and wily enemy to deal with, and as yet we did not know whether the Count might not be in the house. In the dining-room, which lay at the back of the hall, we found 8 boxes of earth. 8 boxes only, out of the 9 which we sought. Our work was not over and would never be until we should have found the missing box. First we opened the shutters of the window which looked out across a narrow stone-flagged yard at the blank face of a stable, pointed to look like the front of a miniature house. There were no windows in it, so we were not afraid of being overlooked. We did not lose any time in examining the chests. With the tools which we had brought with us, we opened them one by one, and treated them as we had treated those others in the chapel. It was evident to us that the Count was not at present in the house, and we proceeded to search for any of his effects. After a cursory glance at the rest of the rooms from basement to attic, we came to the conclusion that the dining-room contained any effects which might belong to the Count, and so we proceeded to minutely examine them. They lay in a sort of orderly disorder on the great dining-room table. There were title deeds of the Piccadilly House in a great bundle, deeds of the purchase of the houses at Mile End and Bermondsey, notepaper, envelopes and pens and ink. All were covered up in thin wrapping paper to keep them from the dust. There were also a clothes brush, a brush and comb, and a jug and basin, the latter containing dirty water which was reddened as if with blood. Last of all was a little heap of keys of all sorts and sizes, probably those belonging to the other houses. When we had examined this last find, Lord Godalming and Quincey Morris, taking accurate notes of the various addresses of the houses in the east and the south, took with them the keys in a great bunch, and set out to destroy the boxes in these places. The rest of us are, with what patience we can, awaiting their return, or the coming of the Count. Chapter 23. Dr. Seward's Diary. 3rd of October. The time seemed terribly long whilst we were waiting for the coming of Godalming and Quincey Morris. The Professor tried to keep our minds active by using them all the time. I could see his beneficent purpose by the side glances which he threw from time to time at Harker. The poor fellow is overwhelmed in a misery that is appalling to see. Last night he was a frank, happy-looking man, with strong youthful face full of energy and with dark brown hair. Today he is a drawn, haggard old man whose white hair matches well with the hollow, burning eyes and grief-written lines of his face. His energy is still intact. In fact, he is like a living flame. This may yet be his salvation, for if all goes well, it will tide him over the despairing period. He will then, in a kind of way, wake again to the realities of life. Poor fellow. I thought my own trouble was bad enough, but his. The Professor knows this well enough and is doing his best to keep his mind active. What he has been saying was, under the circumstances, of absorbing interest. As well as I can remember, here it is. "I have studied over and over again since they came into my hands all the papers relating to this monster, and the more I have studied, the greater seems the necessity to utterly stamp him out. All through there are signs of his advance, not only of his power, but of his knowledge of it. As I learned from the researches of my friend Arminius of Budapest, he was in life a most wonderful man, soldier, statesman, and alchemist, which latter was the highest development of the science knowledge of his time. He had a mighty brain, a learning beyond compare, and a heart that knew no fear and no remorse. He dared even to attend the scholomancer, and there was no branch of knowledge of his time that he did not essay.
Well, in him the brain power survives a physical death, though it would seem that memory was not all complete. In some faculties of mine he has been, and is, only a child, but he is growing, and some things that were childish at the first are now of man's stature. He is experimenting and doing it well, and if it had not been that we have crossed his path, he would be yet, he may be yet if we fail, the father or furtherer of a new order of beings, whose road must lead through death, not life.
Harker groaned and said, "And this is all arrayed against my darling. But how is he experimenting? The knowledge may help us to defeat him."
"He has all along since his coming been trying his powers, slowly but surely. That big child-brain of his is working. Well, for us it is as yet a child-brain, for had he dared at the first to attempt certain things, he would long ago have been beyond our power. However, he means to succeed, and a man who has centuries before him can afford to wait and to go slow. Festina lente may well be his motto."
"I fail to understand," said Harker wearily. "Oh, do be more plain to me. Perhaps grief and trouble are dulling my brain."
The professor laid his hand tenderly on his shoulder as he spoke. "Ah, my child, I will be plain. Do you not see how, of late, this monster has been creeping into knowledge experimentally? How he has been making use of the zoophagus patient to effect his entry into friend John's home? For your vampire, though in all afterwards he can come when and how he will, must at the first make entry only when asked thereto by an inmate. But these are not his most important experiments. Do we not see how at the first all these so great boxes were moved by others? He knew not then, but that must be so. But all the time that so great child-brain of his was growing, and he began to consider whether he might not himself move the box. So he began to help. And then, when he found that this be all right, he tried to move them all alone. And so he progress, and he scatter these graves of him, and none but he know where they are hidden. He may have intent to bury them deep in the ground, so that he only use them in the night, or at such time as he can change his form, they do him equal well, and none may know these are his hiding place. But, my child, do not despair. This knowledge come to him just too late. Already all of his lairs but one be sterilized as for him, and before the sunset this shall be so. Then he have no place where he can move and hide. I delayed this morning so that we might be sure. Is there not more at stake for us than for him? Then why we not be even more careful than him? By my clock it is 1 hour, and already, if all be well, friend Arthur and Quincy are on their way to us. Today is our day, and we must go sure, if slow, and lose no chance. See, there are 5 of us when those absent ones return."
Whilst he was speaking, we were startled by a knock at the hall door, the double postman's knock of the telegraph boy. We all moved out to the hall with one impulse, and Van Helsing, holding up his hand to us to keep silence, stepped to the door and opened it. The boy handed in a dispatch. The professor closed the door again, and after looking at the direction, opened it and read it aloud.
"Look out for D. He has just now 12:45 come from Carfax hurriedly and hastened towards the south. He seems to be going the round and may want to see you, Mina."
There was a pause, broken by Jonathan Harker's voice.
"Now, God be thanked, we shall soon meet."
Van Helsing turned to him quickly and said, "God will act in his own way and time. Do not fear and do not rejoice as yet, for what we wish for at the moment may be our undoings."
"I care for nothing now," he answered hotly, "except to wipe out this brute from the face of creation. I would sell my soul to do it." "Oh, hush, hush, my child," said Van Helsing. "God does not purchase souls in this wise, and the devil, though he may purchase, does not keep faith. But God is merciful and just, and knows your pain and your devotion to that dear Madame Mina. Think you how her pain would be doubled did she but hear your wild words. Do not fear any of us. We are all devoted to this cause, and today shall see the end. The time is coming for action. Today this vampire is limit to the powers of man, and till sunset he may not change. It will take him time to arrive here. See, it is 1:20, and there are yet some times before he can hither come, be he never so quick. What we must hope for is that my lord Arthur and Quincy arrive first."
About 30 minutes after we had received Mrs. Harker's telegram, there came a quiet, resolute knock at the hall door. It was just an ordinary knock,
such as is given hourly by thousands of gentlemen, but it made the Professor's heart and mind beat loudly. We looked at each other, and together moved out into the hall. We each held ready to use our various armaments, the spiritual in the left hand, the moral in the right. Van Helsing pulled back the latch, and holding the door half open, stood back, having both hands ready for action. The gladness of our hearts must have shone upon our faces when on the step, close to the door, we saw Lord Godalming and Quincey Morris. They came quickly in and closed the door behind them, the former saying as they moved along the hall, "It is all right. We found both places, 6 boxes in each, and we destroyed them all."
"Destroyed?" asked the Professor.
"For him." We were silent for a minute, and then Quincey said, "There's nothing to do but to wait here. If, however, he doesn't turn up by 5 o'clock, we must start off, for it won't do to leave Mrs. Harker alone after sunset."
"He will be here before long now," said Van Helsing, who had been consulting his pocket-book.
"Nota bene, in Madame's telegram he went south from Carfax. That means he went to cross the river, and he could only do so at slack of tide, which would be something before 1 o'clock. That he went south has a meaning for us. He is as yet only suspicious, and he went from Carfax first to the place where he would suspect interference least. You must have been at Bermondsey only a short time before him. That he is not here already shows that he went to Mile End next. This took him some time, for he would then have to be carried over the river in some way. Believe me, my friends, we shall not have long to wait now. We should have ready some plan of attack, so that we may throw away no chance. Hush! There is no time now. Have all your arms. Be ready!"
He held up a warning hand as he spoke, for we all could hear a key softly inserted in the lock of the hall door. I could not but admire, even at such a moment, the way in which a dominant spirit asserted itself. In all our hunting parties and adventures on different parts of the world, Quincey Morris had always been the one to arrange the plan of action, and Arthur and I had been accustomed to obey him implicitly. Now the old habit seemed to be renewed instinctively. With a swift glance round the room he at once laid out our plan of attack, and without speaking a word, with a gesture, placed us each in position. Van Helsing, Harker and I were just behind the door, so that when it was open the Professor could guard it, whilst we two stepped between the incomer and the door. Godalming behind and Quincey in front stood just out of sight, ready to move in front of the window. We waited in a suspense that made the seconds pass with nightmare slowness. The slow, careful steps came along the hall. The Count was evidently prepared for some surprise. At least he feared it. Suddenly, with a single bound, he leapt into the room, winning a way past us before any of us could raise a hand to stay him. There was something so panther-like in the movements, something so unhuman, that it seemed to sober us all from the shock of his coming. The first to act was Harker, who with a quick movement threw himself before the door leading into the room in the front of the house. As the Count saw us, a horrible sort of snarl passed over his face, showing the eye-teeth long and pointed. But the evil smile as quickly passed into a cold stare of lion-like disdain. His expression again changed, as with a single impulse we all advanced upon him. It was a pity that we had not some better organized plan of attack, for even at the moment I wondered what we were to do. I did not myself know whether our lethal weapons would avail us anything. Harker evidently meant to try the matter, for he had ready his great kukri knife, and made a fierce and sudden cut at him. The blow was a powerful one. Only the diabolical quickness of the Count's leap back saved him. A second less, and the trenchant blade had shorn through his heart. As it was, the point just cut the cloth of his coat, making a wide gap whence a bundle of banknotes and a stream of gold fell out. The expression of the Count's face was so hellish that for a moment I feared for Harker, though I saw him throw the terrible knife aloft again for another stroke. Instinctively I moved forward with a protective impulse, holding the crucifix and wafer in my hand. I felt a mighty power fly along my arm, and it was without surprise that I saw the monster cower back before a similar movement made spontaneously by each one of us. It would be impossible to describe the expression of hate and baffled malignity, of anger and hellish rage which came over the Count's face. His waxen hue became greenish-yellow by the contrast of his burning eyes, and the red scar on the forehead showed on the pallid skin like a palpitating wound. The next instant, with a sinuous dive, he swept under Harker's arm ere his blow could fall, and grasping a handful of the money from the floor, dashed across the room and threw himself at the window.
Amid the crash and glitter of the falling glass, he tumbled into the flagged area below. Through the sound of the shivering glass I could hear the ting of the gold as some of the sovereigns fell on the flagging. We ran over and saw him spring unhurt from the ground. He, rushing up the steps, crossed the flagged yard and pushed open the stable door. There he turned and spoke to us.
"You think to baffle me, you, with your pale faces all in a row, like sheep in a butcher's. You shall be sorry yet, each one of you. You think you have left me without a place to rest, but I have more. My revenge is just begun. I spread it over centuries, and time is on my side. Your girls that you all love are mine already, and through them you and others shall yet be mine, my creatures to do my bidding and to be my jackals when I want to feed. Bah!"
With a contemptuous sneer, he passed quickly through the door, and we heard the rusty bolt creak as he fastened it behind him. A door beyond opened and shut. The first of us to speak was the professor, as realizing the difficulty of following him through the stable, we moved towards the hall.
"We have learnt something. Much. Notwithstanding his brave words, he fears us. He fear time. He fear want. For if not, why he hurry so? His very tone betray him, or my ears deceive. Why take that money? You follow quick. You are hunters of wild beasts, and understand it so. For me, I make sure that nothing here may be of use to him, if so that he return."
As he spoke, he put the money remaining into his pocket, took the title deeds in the bundle as Harker had left them, and swept the remaining things into the open fireplace, where he set fire to them with a match. Godalming and Morris had rushed out into the yard, and Harker had lowered himself from the window to follow the count. He had, however, bolted the stable door, and by the time they had forced it open there was no sign of him. Van Helsing and I tried to make inquiry at the back of the house, but the mews was deserted, and no one had seen him depart. It was now late in the afternoon, and sunset was not far off. We had to recognize that our game was up. With heavy hearts, we agreed with the professor, when he said,
"Let us go back to Madame Mina. Poor, poor dear Madame Mina. All we can do just now is done, and we can there at least protect her. But we need not despair. There is but one more earth-box, and we must try to find it. When that is done, all may yet be well."
I could see that he spoke as bravely as he could to comfort Harker. The poor fellow was quite broken down. Now and again he gave a low groan which he could not suppress. He was thinking of his wife. With sad hearts we came back to my house, where we found Mrs. Harker awaiting us, with an appearance of cheerfulness which did honour to her bravery and unselfishness. When she saw our faces, her own became as pale as death. For a second or two her eyes were closed, as if she were in secret prayer, and then she said cheerfully,
"I can never thank you all enough. Oh, my poor darling!"
As she spoke, she took her husband's grey head in her hands and kissed it.
"Lay your poor head here and rest it. All will yet be well, dear. God will protect us, if he so will it in his good intent."
The poor fellow only groaned. There was no place for words in his sublime misery. We had a sort of perfunctory supper together, and I think it cheered us all up somewhat. It was perhaps the mere animal heat of food to hungry people, for none of us had eaten anything since breakfast, or the sense of companionship may have helped us, but anyhow we were all less miserable and saw the morrow as not altogether without hope. True to our promise, we told Mrs. Harker everything which had passed, and although she grew snowy white at times when danger had seemed to threaten her husband, and red at others when his devotion to her was manifested, she listened bravely and with calmness. When we came to the part where Harker had rushed at the Count so recklessly, she clung to her husband's arm and held it tight as though her clinging could protect him from any harm that might come. She said nothing, however, till the narration was all done, and matters had been brought right up to the present time. Then, without letting go her husband's hand, she stood up amongst us and spoke. Oh, that I could give any idea of the scene, of that sweet, sweet, good, good woman, in all the radiant beauty of her youth and animation, with the red scar on her forehead of which she was conscious, and which we saw with grinding of our teeth, remembering whence and how it came. Her loving kindness against our grim hate, her tender faith against all our fears and doubting, and we, knowing that so far as symbols went, she with all her goodness and purity and faith was outcast from God.
"Jonathan,"
she said, and the word sounded like music on her lips, it was so full of love and tenderness.
"Jonathan, dear, and you all, my true, true friends, I want you to bear something in mind through all this dreadful time. I know that you must fight, that you must destroy, even as you destroyed the false Lucy, so that the true Lucy might live hereafter. But it is not a work of hate. That poor soul who has wrought all this misery is the saddest case of all. Just think what will be his joy when he too is destroyed in his worser part, that his better part may have spiritual immortality. You must be pitiful to him too, though it may not hold your hands from his destruction."
As she spoke, I could see her husband's face darken and draw together, as though the passion in him were shriveling his being to its core. Instinctively the clasp on his wife's hand grew closer, till his knuckles looked white. She did not flinch from the pain which I knew she must have suffered, but looked at him with eyes that were more appealing than ever. As she stopped speaking, he leapt to his feet, almost tearing his hand from hers as he spoke. "May God give him into my hand, just for long enough to destroy that earthly life of him which we are aiming at. If beyond it I could send his soul for ever and ever to burning hell, I would do it."
"Oh, hush! Oh, hush, in the name of good God! Don't say such things, Jonathan, my husband, or you will crush me with fear and horror. Just think, my dear, I have been thinking all this long, long day of it, that perhaps, some day, I too may need such pity, and that some other like you, and with equal cause for anger, may deny it to me. Oh, my husband, my husband, indeed I would have spared you such a thought had there been another way. But I pray that God may not have treasured your wild words except as the heart-broken wail of a very loving and sorely stricken man. O God, let these poor white hairs go in evidence of what he has suffered, who all his life has done no wrong, and on whom so many sorrows have come."
We men were all in tears now. There was no resisting them, and we wept openly. She wept, too, to see that her sweeter counsels had prevailed. Her husband flung himself on his knees beside her, and putting his arms round her, hid his face in the folds of her dress. Van Helsing beckoned to us, and we stole out of the room, leaving the two loving hearts alone with God. Before they retired, the professor fixed up the room against any coming of the vampire, and assured Mrs. Harker that she might rest in peace. She tried to school herself to the belief, and manifestly, for her husband's sake, tried to seem content. It was a brave struggle, and was, I think and believe, not without its reward. Van Helsing had placed at hand a bell which either of them was to sound in case of any emergency. When they had retired, Quincy, Godalming, and I arranged that we should sit up, dividing the night between us, and watch over the safety of the poor, stricken lady. The first watch falls to Quincy, so the rest of us will be off to bed as soon as we can. Godalming has already turned in, for his is the second watch. Now that my work is done, I too shall go to bed. Jonathan Harker's Journal. 3rd to 4th of October, close to midnight. I thought yesterday would never end. There was over me a yearning for sleep in some sort of blind belief that to wake would be to find things changed, and that any change must now be for the better. Before we parted, we discussed what our next step was to be, but we could arrive at no result. All we knew was that one earth box remained, and that the Count alone knew where it was. If he chooses to lie hidden, he may baffle us for years, and in the meantime... The thought is too horrible. I dare not think of it even now. This I know, that if ever there was a woman who was all perfection, that one is my poor, wronged darling. I love her a thousand times more for her sweet pity of last night, a pity that made my own hate of the monster seem despicable. Surely God will not permit the world to be the poorer by the loss of such a creature. This is hope to me. We are all drifting reefwards now, and faith is our only anchor. Thank God, Mina is sleeping, and sleeping without dreams. I fear what her dreams might be like, with such terrible memories to ground them on. She has not been so calm within my seeing since the sunset. Then for a while there came over her face a repose which was like spring after the blasts of March. I thought at the time that it was the softness of the red sunset on her face, but somehow now I think it had a deeper meaning. I'm not sleepy myself, though I am weary, weary to death. However, I must try to sleep, for there is tomorrow to think of,
and there is no rest for me until... later. I must have fallen asleep, for I was awakened by Mina, who was sitting up in bed with a startled look on her face. I could see easily, for we did not leave the room in darkness. She had placed a warning hand over my mouth, and now she whispered in my ear,
"Hush! There is someone in the corridor!"
I got up softly, and, crossing the room, gently opened the door. Just outside, stretched on a mattress, lay Mr. Morris, wide awake. He raised a warning hand for silence as he whispered to me,
"Hush! Go back to bed. It's all right. One of us will be here all night. We don't mean to take any chances."
His look and gesture forbade discussion, so I came back and told Mina. She sighed, and positively a shadow of a smile stole over her poor, pale face as she put her arms round me and said softly, "Oh, thank God for good, brave men." With a sigh she sank back again to sleep. I write this as I am not sleepy, though I must try again. 4th of October, morning. Once again, during the night, I was wakened by Mina. This time we had all had a good sleep, for the grey of the coming dawn was making the windows into sharp oblongs, and the gas flame was like a speck rather than a disk of light. She said to me hurriedly,
"Go call the professor. I want to see him at once."
"Why?" I asked.
"I have an idea. I suppose it must have come in the night and matured without my knowing it. He must hypnotize me before the dawn, and then I shall be able to speak. Go quick, dearest. The time is getting close."
I went to the door. Dr. Seward was resting on the mattress, and seeing me, he sprang to his feet. "Is anything wrong?" he asked, in alarm.
"No," I replied, "but Mina wants to see Dr. Helsing at once."
"I will go," he said, and hurried into the professor's room. 2 or 3 minutes later, Van Helsing was in the room in his dressing gown, and Mr. Morris and Lord Godalming were with Dr. Seward at the door asking questions. When the professor saw Mina, a smile, a positive smile, ousted the anxiety of his face. He rubbed his hands as he said,
"Oh, my dear Madam Mina, this is indeed a change. See, friend Jonathan, we have got our dear Madam Mina, as of old, back to us today."
Then, turning to her, he said cheerfully,
"And what am I do for you? For at this hour you do not want me for nothings."
"I want you to hypnotize me," she said.
"Do it before the dawn, for I feel that then I can speak and speak freely. Be quick, for the time is short."
Without a word, he motioned her to sit up in bed. Looking fixedly at her, he commenced to make passes in front of her, from over the top of her head downward, with each hand in turn. Mina gazed at him fixedly for a few minutes, during which my own heart beat like a trip-hammer, for I felt that some crisis was at hand. Gradually her eyes closed, and she sat stock still. Only by the gentle heaving of her bosom could one know that she was alive. The professor made a few more passes and then stopped, and I could see that his forehead was covered with great beads of perspiration. Mina opened her eyes, but she did not seem the same woman. There was a faraway look in her eyes, and her voice had a sad dreaminess which was new to me. Raising his hand to impose silence, the professor motioned me to bring the others in. They came on tiptoe, closing the door behind them, and stood at the foot of the bed, looking on. Mina appeared not to see them. The stillness was broken by Van Helsing's voice speaking in a low, level tone which would not break the current of her thoughts.
"Where are you?"
The answer came in a neutral way.
"I do not know. Sleep has no place it can call its own."
For several minutes there was silence. Mina sat rigid, and the professor stood staring at her fixedly, and the rest of us hardly dared to breathe. The room was growing lighter. Without taking his eyes from Mina's face, Dr. Van Helsing motioned me to pull up the blind. I did so, and the day seemed just upon us. A red streak shot up, and a rosy light seemed to diffuse itself through the room. On the instant, the professor spoke again.
"Where are you now?"
The answer came dreamily, but with intention. It was as though she were interpreting something. I have heard her use the same tone when reading her notes.
"I do not know. It is all strange to me."
"What do you see?"
"I can see nothing. It is all dark."
"What do you hear?"
I could detect the strain in the professor's patient voice.
"The lapping of water. It is gurgling by, and little waves leap. I can hear them on the outside."
Then you are on a ship? We all looked at each other, trying to glean something each from the other. We were afraid to think. The answer came quick.
Oh, yes.
What else do you hear?
The sound of men stamping overhead as they run about. There is the creaking of a chain, and the loud tinkle as the check of the capstan falls into the ratchet.
What are you doing?
I am still. Oh, so still. It is like death.
The voice faded away into a deep breath, as of one sleeping, and the open eyes closed again. By this time the sun had risen, and we were all in the full light of day. Dr. Van Helsing placed his hands on Mina's shoulders, and laid her head down softly on her pillow. She lay like a sleeping child for a few moments, and then, with a long sigh, awoke and stared in wonder to see us all around her.
"Have I been talking in my sleep?" was all she said.
She seemed, however, to know the situation without telling, though she was eager to know what she had told. The professor repeated the conversation, and she said,
"Then there is not a moment to lose. It may not be yet too late."
Mr. Morris and Lord Godalming started for the door, but the professor's calm voice called them back.
"Stay, my friends. That ship, wherever it was weighing anchor whilst she spoke. There are many ships weighing anchor at the moment in your so great port of London. Which of them is it that you seek? God be thanked that we have once again a clue, though whither it may lead us we know not. We have been blind somewhat, blind after the manner of men, since when we can look back, we see what we might have seen looking forward, if we had been able to see what we might have seen. Alas, but that sentence is a puddle, is it not? We can know now what was in the Count's mind when he seized the money, though Jonathan's so fierce knife put him in the danger that even he dread. He meant escape. Hear me. Escape. He saw that with but one earth box left, and a pack of men following like dogs after a fox. This London was no place for him. He have take his last earth box on board a ship, and he leave the land. He think to escape, but no, we follow him. Tally-ho, as friend Arthur would say when he put on his red frock. Our old fox is wily, oh so wily, and we must follow with wile. I too am wily, and I think his mind in a little while. In meantime we may rest and in peace, for there are waters between us which he do not want to pass, and which he could not if he would, unless the ship were to touch the land, and then only at full or slack tide. See, and the sun is just rose, and all day to sunset is to us. Let us take bath and dress, and have breakfast which we all need, and which we can eat comfortable, since he be not in the same land with us.
Mina looked at him appealingly as she asked,
"But why need we seek him further, when he has gone away from us?"
He took her hand and patted it as he replied, "Ask me nothing as yet. When we have breakfast, then I answer all questions." He would say no more, and we separated to dress. After breakfast, Mina repeated her question. He looked at her gravely for a minute and then said sorrowfully,
"Because, my dear, dear Madame Mina, now more than ever must we find him, even if we have to follow him to the jaws of hell."
She grew paler as she asked faintly, "Why?"
"Because," he answered solemnly, "he can live for centuries, and you are but mortal woman. Time is now to be dreaded, since once he put that mark upon your throat."
I was just in time to catch her as she fell forward in a faint. Chapter 24. Dr. Seward's phonograph diary, spoken by Van Helsing. "This to Jonathan Harker. You are to stay with your dear Madame Mina. We shall go to make our search, if I can call it so, for it is not search but knowing, and we seek confirmation only. But do you stay and take care of her today? This is your best and most holiest office. This day nothing can find him here. Let me tell you that so you will know what we four know already, for I have tell them. He, our enemy, have gone away. He have gone back to his castle in Transylvania. I know it so well, as if a great hand of fire wrote it on the wall. He have prepared for this in some way, and that last earth box was ready to ship somewheres. For this he took the money. For this he hurried at the last, lest we catch him before the sun go down. It was his last hope, save that he might hide in the tomb, that he think poor Miss Lucy, being as he thought like him, keep open to him. but there was not of time. When that fail, he make straight for his last resource, his last earthwork, I might say, did I wish double entente. He is clever. Oh, so clever. He know that his game here was finished, and so he decide he go back home. He find ship going by the route he came, and he go in it. We go off now to find what ship and whither bound. When we have discovered that, we come back and tell you all. Then we will comfort you and poor dear Madam Mina with new hope, for it will be hope when you think it over, that all is not lost. This very creature that we pursue, he take hundreds of years to get so far as London, and yet in one day, when we know of the disposal of him, we drive him out. He is finite, though he is powerful to do much harm, and suffers not as we do. But we are strong, each in our purpose, and we are all more strong together. Take heart afresh, dear husband of Madam Mina. This battle is but begun, and in the end we shall win, so sure as that God sits on high to watch over his children. Therefore be of much comfort till we return. Van Helsing. Jonathan Harker's Journal. 4th of October. When I read to Mina Van Helsing's message in the phonograph, the poor girl brightened up considerably. Already the certainty that the Count is out of the country has given her comfort, and comfort is strength to her. For my own part, now that this horrible danger is not face to face with us, it seems almost impossible to believe in it. Even my own terrible experiences in Castle Dracula seem like a long-forgotten dream, here in the crisp autumn air, in the bright sunlight. Alas, how can I disbelieve? In the midst of my thought, my eye fell on the red scar on my poor darling's white forehead. Whilst that lasts, there can be no disbelief. And afterwards the very memory of it will keep faith crystal clear. Mina and I fear to be idle, so we have been over all the diaries again and again. Somehow, although the reality seems greater each time, the pain and the fear seem less. There is something of a guiding purpose manifest throughout which is comforting. Mina says that perhaps we are the instruments of ultimate good. It may be. I shall try to think as she does. We have never spoken to each other yet of the future. It is better to wait till we see the professor and the others after their investigations. The day is running by more quickly than I ever thought a day could run for me again. It is now 3 o'clock. Mina Harker's Journal. 5th of October, 5 p.m. Our meeting for report. Present Professor Van Helsing, Lord Godalming, Dr. Seward, Mr. Quincy Morris, Jonathan Harker, Mina Harker. Dr. Van Helsing described what steps were taken during the day to discover on what boat and whither bound Count Dracula made his escape. As I knew that he wanted to get back to Transylvania, I felt sure that he must go by the Danube mouth, or by somewhere in the Black Sea, since by that way he come. It was a dreary blank that was before us, omne ignotum pro magnifico. And so, with heavy hearts, we start to find what ships leave for the Black Sea last night. He was in sailing ship, since Madame Mina tells of sails being set. These not so important as to go in your list of the shipping in the Times, and so we go, by suggestion of my Lord Godalming, to your Lloyd's, where are note of all ships that sail, however so small. There we find that only one Black Sea-bound ship go out with the tide. She is the Tsarina Catherine, and she sail from Doolittle's Wharf for Varna, and thence on to other parts and up the Danube. So, said I, this is the ship whereon is the Count. So off we go to Doolittle's Wharf, and there we find a man in an office of wood so small that the man looked bigger than the office. From him we inquire of the goings of the Tsarina Catherine. He swear much, and he red face and loud of voice, but he good fellow all the same. And when Quincy give him something from his pocket, which crackle as he roll it up, and put it in a so small bag which he have hid deep in his clothing, he still better fellow and humble servant to us. He come with us, and ask many men who are rough and hot. These be better fellows too, when they have been no more thirsty. They say much of blood and bloom, and of others which I comprehend not, though I guess what they mean. But nevertheless they tell us all things which we want to know. They make known to us among them how last afternoon at about 5 o'clock comes a man so hurry. A tall man, thin and pale, with high nose and teeth so white, and eyes that seem to be burning. That he be all in black, except that he have a hat of straw which suit not him all the time. That he scatter his money in making quick inquiry as to what ship sails for the Black Sea and for where. Some took him to the office, and then to the ship, where he will not go aboard but halt at shore end of gangplank, and ask that the captain come to him. The captain come, when told that he will be pay well, and though he swear much at the first, he agree to term. Then the thin man go, and someone tell him where horse and cart can be hired. He go there, and soon he come again, himself driving cart on which is a great box. This he himself lift down, though it takes several to put it on truck for the ship. He give much talk to captain as to how and where his box is to be placed. But the captain like it not, and swear at him in many tongues, and tell him that if he like he can come and see where it shall be. But he say, no, that he come not yet, for that he have much to do. Whereupon the captain tell him that he had better be quick, with blood, for that his ship will leave the place of blood before the turn of the tide, with blood. Then the thin man smile and say that of course he must go when he think fit, but he will be surprised if he go quite so soon. The captain swear again, polyglot, and the thin man make him bow and thank him and say that he will so far intrude on his kindness as to come aboard before the sailing. Finally the captain, more red than ever and in more tongues, tell him that he doesn't want no Frenchmen, with bloom upon them and also with blood in his ship, with blood on her also. And so, after asking where there might be close at hand a ship where he might purchase ship's forms, he departed. No one knew where he went, or bloomin' well cared, as they said, for they had something else to think of. Well, with blood again, for it soon became apparent to all that the Tsarina Catherine would not sail as was expected. A thin mist began to creep up from the river, and it grew and grew till soon a dense fog. He must have come off by himself, for none noticed him. Polyglot, very polyglot. Polyglot with bloom and blood, but he could do nothing. The water rose and rose, and he began to fear that he would lose the tide altogether. He was in no friendly mood when just at full tide the thin man came up the gangplank again and asked to see where his box had been stowed. Then the captain replied that he wished that he and his box, old and with much bloom and blood, were in hell. But the thin man did not be offend, and went down with the mate and saw where it was place, and came up and stood a while on deck in fog. He must have come off by himself, for none noticed him. Indeed they thought not of him, for soon the fog began to melt away, and all was clear again. My friends of the thirst, and the language that was of bloom and blood, laughed, as they told how the captain's swears exceeded even his usual polyglot, and was more than ever full of picturesque. When, on questioning other mariners who were in movement up and down the river that hour, he found that few of them had seen any of fog at all, except where it lay around the wharf. However, the ship went out on the ebb tide, and was doubtless by morning far down the river mouth. She was by then, when they told us, well out to sea. And so, my dear Madame Mina, it is that we have to rest for a time, for our enemy is on the sea, with the fog at his command, on his way to the Danube mouth. To sail a ship takes time. Go she never so quick, and when we start we go aland more quick, and we meet him there. Our best hope is to come on him when in the box between sunrise and sunset, for then he can make no struggle, and we may deal with him as we should. There are days for us in which we can make ready our plan. We know all about where he go, for we have seen the owner of the ship, who have shown us invoices and all papers that can be. The box we seek is to be landed in Varna and to be given to an agent, one Ristix, who will there present his credentials. And so our merchant friend will have done his part. When he asks if there be any wrong, for that so he can telegraph and have inquiry made at Varna, we say, no, for what is to be done is not for the police or of the customs. It must be done by us alone and in our own way.